first case for argument this morning is Roe Medgett versus CC Services. Mr. Ashman?
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court. My name is Dale Ashman. I represent the plaintiff appellant in this case, Paula Roe and Paul Decker, and four classes of employees under the Fair Labor Standards Act, material damage appraisers two, field claim rep two and three, and property specialist one. This case finds itself here before the appellate court as a result of the trial court entering summary judgment as to all four classes in behalf of CCSI, the defendant appellee here. The question here for the court is whether the trial court correctly applied the standard of summary judgment, that is, whether there was a genuine issue of material fact. Now, in making that determination, the plaintiff was entitled, the non-movement plaintiff was entitled to have it accepted as true the evidence of the non-moving party, to have all evidence construed in its favor, and to have all reasonable inferences construed in its favor. I think even a cursory review of the court's order reflects that that is not what happened. Now, the law being applied here is the applicability of the administrative exemption under the Fair Labor Standards Act. That is a mixed question of law and fact. What the employees actually do is a question of fact. The applicability of the law, of the exemption to those duties, is a question of law for the court. Now, in applying this, the court is supposed to narrowly construe the exemption against the employer, and the employer further bears the burden of proving the exemption. Now, in looking at the court's order, the district court specifically said that it considered only the facts that were neither disputed nor objected to. Now, that very finding, that approaching the factual determination in that way, put the non-movements at a distinct disadvantage. Obviously, if all you need to do is object to the other party's facts, it makes the summary judgment inquiry fairly easy, and that simply can't be the standard. We are faced with a situation where the trial court literally disregarded pages and pages of facts that were offered by the non-movement. Particularly today, I want to be clear to distinguish between the class of material damage appraiser from the other three classes, that being the field claims reps two and three, which for today's purposes I'll just call field claims reps collectively because their jobs don't really differ all that much, and the property specialists. The material damage appraisers are different in kind from the other classes because they are appraisers. They are exactly that. They are fact finders.
Counsel, before you go any further with the substance of your argument, just a procedural question. You didn't move, cross-move for summary judgment in this case?
Yes, Your Honor, we did.
Oh, you did? Okay.
We cross-moved for summary judgment, and that was denied.
Okay, so you are not suggesting that there are factual disputes that require a trial. You're asking for judgment in your favor?
Well, we are asking for judgment in our favor as to the material damage appraiser two class, but in the alternative, if the court determines there are factual issues that need to be resolved, then to be remanded to trial court.
But that's not your position, that there are factual disputes that require a trial.
Well, there are no factual issues from our perspective. In their motion for summary judgment, there very much are factual issues raised. I mean, we're
That's
shooting past each other.
I'm trying to clarify the procedural argument that you opened with. Exactly what are you asking us to do?
We're asking you very clearly to determine that there are no genuine issues of material fact with respect to the appellant's motion for summary judgment and that we should be granted judgment on the pleadings.
Okay. Thanks.
Now, there are five categories of facts with respect to the material damage appraisers that were neglected. Those pertain to skill and experience, negotiation, usage of software, oversight, and coverage issues. Now, after the appellants filed their brief in this court, there was a case that was cited called In Re Farmers. The Ninth Circuit subsequently overruled that case. But in overruling that case, the court provided information that is probative to the issues before us, and that being that it referenced a 1963 opinion letter which stated that reaching an agreed price for repairs is not enough to constitute negotiation. Again, the reason for being for a material damage appraiser is to inspect vehicles and write estimates to repair. Now, in undertaking the analysis under the Fair Labor Standards Act, particularly this administrative exception, there are three prongs. The parties don't dispute the fact that there's a salary basis. The parties don't dispute that this is non-manual work. What is disputed, though, is whether or not the primary duty is directly related to management policies or general business operations, and secondly, whether any of these classes include work requiring the exercise of discretion and independent judgment. With respect to the MDAs, the record before the trial court was very clear that MDAs can't deny claims, they don't decide liability issues, they don't negotiate with insureds, they simply talk to the insureds, they don't decide total loss situations. These folks are not file handlers. They receive a file from either the central claims office or they receive a file from a field claims representative and they're told, go out and get an estimate. They write the estimate. They deal with the auto body shops, but that is not at all the kind of negotiation that's contemplated by the Department of Labor regulations.
What do they not do in once they hit to get the file that you think would put them in the non-discretionary category? What would they have to do in addition to make the meet that test?
Well, Your Honor, I think the cases are relatively clear, and if I even look at the cases cited by the appellee in this matter, it's meaningful negotiations if you're dealing with attorneys, if you're negotiating with the insured as the amount that's going to be paid, if you're deciding issues of liability, if you're deciding whether coverage exists, whether you can deny a claim. All of those kinds of factors, and it's important to keep in mind that when you're looking at doing this analysis, it's a very, very fact-specific analysis. It's essentially a totality of the circumstances argument that you can't just call someone an adjuster and get the exemption. In the same way, you can't simply say, oh, they negotiate, therefore they're an exempt employee. And that's precisely what happened at the trial court. The only fact that the appellee was able to develop with respect to the material damage appraiser position that bore on negotiation was during the deposition of Paula Rowe. She acknowledged that she sometimes negotiates with the auto body shops. And upon clarification, she essentially explained away that that's just, you know, she has good people skills, and that she's sometimes able to get a good deal on auto parts. Well, that's precisely what the Department of Labor Regulations 1963 opinion letter was talking about when it said reaching agreed price for repairs is not negotiation. Now, MDAs don't determine policy. They're more akin to an insurance inspector. They essentially tabulate data. They fill out forms, and they report to others. Under prong three, concerning comparing and evaluating possible courses of conduct and whether they have any authority or power to make independent choice free from immediate direction or supervision with respect to matters of significance. And on the Marine Corps, we used to call that henpecking and fly specking. These folks are either watched very closely while they're doing it, they're following very exacting standards, or they're scrutinized immediately after they've carried out their functions. So the Reich case, which was cited by this court, at least noted by this court in the Haywood opinion, recognizing the distinction between an adjuster and an appraiser. Kennedy versus Commonwealth is another example where when this court was talking about a supply analyst is a non-exempt or could be an exempt employee if acquiring parts are simply a matter of contacting the hardware store. And knowledge and skill. Now, the trial court itself misapplied the standard for actually what it was looking at. It made specific findings about skill and knowledge, and somehow, inexplicably, turned that around to somehow favor the employer. There's several instances here where, for instance, the court said MDAs are required to use their skill, knowledge, and experience to determine if there is any pre-existing damage. They use skill to determine what particular damage looks like, for instance, a deer hit. They have rules of thumb. They learn the application of this kind of estimate based upon experience and what they have learned on the job. And there's just any number of facts like that that the court found and then turned around. For instance, the decision to repair or replace a part is a function of skill and knowledge rather than judgment. I mean, that is the classic example of what an inspector or an appraiser does. Then, inexplicably, the court says, while MDAs use ADP, that's a software tool, as a tool, the ADP does not take discretion and judgment away from ADP, from MDAs. It doesn't assist in the process. Well, the court just got earlier made a factual finding that whether to repair or replace is a function of skill or knowledge. Then they turn around and say ADP doesn't assist and somehow uses that fact against the MDAs to say that they ought to be exempt.
Mr. Ashman, I know you're into rebuttal time, and of course that's your choice. But I appreciate the emphasis you've done with the MDAs, and I imagine you do not want us to take any suggestion of emphasis there that on the field reps and property, what are they called?
The property specialists?
Property specialists, that you're abandoning your argument. But is it fair to say your brief does very little to explain their job positions in contrast to the MDAs?
I think that is accurate, but Your Honor, as counsel for this class, the court applied the wrong standard as to all of them, and so they have a right.
You wouldn't argue, would you, with the trial court's assessment of the discretion that's exercised by the other two groups?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think I can say that given the number of genuine material facts that were disregarded by the trial court.
What would you point to in those two categories? I appreciate your argument on the MDA, but the MDAs. But what would be the most glaring error by the trial court with regard to the field claim representatives and the property specialists?
The use of software, for instance. That was a fact that was entirely disregarded by the trial court. The exacting standards under the best practices by the Big Red Manual. There were two affidavits that were disregarded. One affidavit bore entirely on the field claims reps and the property specialists. And
that their job is so programmed, is that by the...
That's right, Your Honor.
So if a CEO of a Fortune 500 company was computer literate and did a lot of projections based on economic models generated by a computer, you would suggest that CEO's not exercising discretion in his or her supervisory role of a corporation?
Well, I think by definition, Your Honor, the CEO is charged with management.
Down to the third vice president who's relying on a computer. Don't you suggest that that's a robotic approach to say that the computer is taking over in the discretion area of the two classes we're talking about?
Well, perhaps, Your Honor, but it goes even further than that. It's the computer associated with other guidelines. It's not simply that.
All right. Well, I want you to save some time,
Thank you.
At least if you wish to. Mr. Heidenreich?
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Roger Heidenreich. I represent the defendant, CC Services. My co-counsel is Kate Douglas, who is with me here today. Why don't I start with the standard on summary judgment where Mr. Ashman began. This court reviews this matter de novo, and it is absolutely the case that it should consider the entire record in deciding the summary judgment issue. And it should, in fact, also draw all reasonable inferences in favor of the non-movement when it does that. That's exactly the standard, by the way, that the district court lays out on page 21 of its opinion. And what you conclude from that, after you do that, is that there are no genuine factual issues here. Because as Mr. Ashman points out, he's looking for summary judgment as well. He doesn't believe there are disputed issues of fact here either. The reason why there aren't genuine issues of material fact are really explained by three things. Many of the assertions that the plaintiffs make here are not supported by evidence, are not supported by citations, and you'll see that over and over again in the brief. Secondly, most of the assertions that they make do not contradict the facts that support summary judgment, either because they're extraneous facts, tangential, as the district court recognized them on the motion to reconsider. And finally, another reason why they don't create genuine issues of material fact is that they contradict directly the deposition testimony that the plaintiffs gave in this case. Once you consider the entire factual record together, summary judgment is appropriate. The administrative exemption is what is at issue, and there's really only two prongs of it that I think are at issue as well in the short test. One is whether the duties, primary duties, are directly related to the management policies or general business operations of the employer or its customers. And here they clearly were. Directly related, according to the regulations, means significance to the business. And one can hardly deny that the undisputed facts show that here. CC Services contracts with insurance companies to provide claims adjusting services. That claims division, on an annual basis, adjusts claims in the amount of $606 million. And the employees in this case are those employees. Material damage appraisers, for example, and a lot of emphasis has been put on that by the plaintiffs here, adjust 60% of all claims. It is an enormous, substantial impact on the financial operations of the insurance company customers. 95% of all claims settle under $10,000, and every one of these adjusters has, at a minimum, $12,000 worth of authority. So this big financial impact is one that is done by these employees. They're important.
Is the distinction among these three categories the amount of authority they have to settle claims?
No, I don't believe so. And that's,
that a distinction?
I don't believe so, because all of them have, at a minimum, $12,000. Property specialists have $20,000 in authority.
And in fact, is that the distinction?
I don't believe that it is.
What is it?
I believe it's the duties that they perform are what the court should be looking at. And I think that's what the Ninth Circuit recognized in the Farmer's decision, that simply because some claims might be small doesn't mean that they're not exercising discretion and independent judgment, and that they're not of substantial importance to the business.
That's what I'm asking. They're not unimportant just because they're small.
That's right.
And I'm asking, is the distinction that some are bigger than others, and that's how these three groups are separated?
No, because actually field claims representatives, for example, have $12,000 in authority, so do material damage appraisers. The dollar amount of the authority for that group starts at the same level. So I don't think it's just the dollar amount. I think ultimately one needs to look at the duties that they perform in applying the regulation. The dollar amount is significant because it shows, in fact, that they have substantial authority and can affect substantially the operation of the insurance company.
So, Mr. Heidenreich, is it your position that there's no ministerial aspect to what the MDAs do?
No, I wouldn't say that as to anything that they do.
More ministerial than the other two categories.
I'm not sure I would agree with that. And I think the reason I don't agree with that is that they are so largely unsupervised. They spend almost all of their time away from the office, and they have substantial authority to resolve those claims.
A meter reader for a utility company is basically unsupervised, isn't it? A meter reader goes to a home or commercial enterprise, and I'm not analogizing it completely, but that's it. I mean, just operating alone doesn't remove your ministerial hat, does it?
No, it does not, in all fairness. And, in fact, what you do, again, I think, is you have to look at the actual duties that they perform. Take one example that an MDA performs, and that's the decision about whether to repair or replace a part. Got a damaged fender. Now, are we going to straighten it out, or are we going to buy a brand new fender? On Ms. Rowe's deposition, she testified that that decision about whether to repair or replace the part is a matter of significance, because it's more cost effective if you can repair the part rather than replace
it. Analogy to the plumber that comes to your home, who makes that judgment call on a valve versus a new faucet.
No, I don't think so. And I think here's the difference, because what you're doing, in the words of the regulation, is comparing and evaluating possible courses of conduct, in this case, whether to repair or replace the part, on a matter of significance. And then after that, Ms. Rowe testified that that's the type of negotiation that you engage in with the repair shop.
Well, Mr. Heinrich, is your position that because they're the building block of the company's operation, that is, that they're the ones that interact with the body shop initially, that alone, or not alone, is a critical indicator that they are people that are exercising this company judgment?
It is a critical indicator. The regulations talk about representing the company or negotiating as things to look for in applying the administrative exemption. A material damage appraiser, if you've got have a car accident, the material damage appraiser is the person you're going to see. They are the face of the company. They do represent the company. They come out to you. They explain the estimate to you. Hopefully you'll have no problems, and they're the only person, in fact, you're going to see. They represent the company in all sorts of important ways, and when you think about the business adjusting policies of these insurance companies, these are the employees that implement those policies.
If they have that critical eyeballing, high discretion responsibility, why is it layered? Why would there be two layers above them? In other words, and why would you limit them to 12,000? Why not limit them if they want to total the car? Why wouldn't you just say in a relatively new vehicle they could be higher? Why cap them if they are possessed of this unique viewing discretion, so to speak?
I suppose it's the case that in any organization, everybody's authority is going to be capped at some point. We couldn't allow MDAs to, or any employee, for that matter, to adjust a claim in an unlimited amount.
Corporate structure. But is the MDA a route to moving on to just historically either a field rep or a property specialist?
No. In fact, they're really different career paths. MDAs can become MDAs 3s. It gives them a higher level of authority. They're not at issue in the particular case. But field claims representatives and property specialists resolve property multi-line claims of a different nature. MDAs resolve vehicle damage claims.
Is it fair to say that their talent is assessing material damage?
That is certainly one of them.
What do they perform beyond that?
In assessing the damage, if I can start there for a minute, first you look at the part to determine whether it is consistent with the insured's version of the events. In other words, is there pre-existing damage? You've got to make a decision about that. You need to make a decision about whether it is properly classified as coverage versus collision. You've got to make a decision about whether or not there are any indicators of fraud. So in assessing that, a number of decisions come away from that.
Is there a business decision component like this. Can an MDA say the car is currently located at the Acme body shop? Can an MDA on behalf of the company say this repair has to be made at the Jones body shop?
Not in our company. I don't know if other companies are allowed to do that, but in our company they are not. It's not, that fact is not in the record, but...
Well, I'm just trying to see if there's a greater sweep of authority. I
understand. And after that assessment then, the decision to repair or replace a part, negotiation can occur with the body shop, with the insureds, and that's Ms. Rowe's testimony. Not our characterization of it, and with claimants as well, about what is the proper repair and what should be done here. And it is a matter of, I believe, tremendous significance to the company. Ms. Rowe really shows, I think, and highlights the discretion and independence that comes with negotiation in the testimony that she gave. And I just wanted to read a short snippet of it because I think it demonstrates how this negotiation process matters for MDAs. We were discussing at the time why her claims average was below the district average, and here's what she said. My question was, and why do you think you were able to come in below average? She said, because I believe I had, good negotiation skills. She attributes her good performance to these skills. That's how important they are. And then I'd simply asked her, tell me what you mean by that. It wasn't a leading question. I wasn't directing her where to go. She simply said, well, I believe that I was able to get a fair estimate. That's discretion and independent judgment. Fair estimate of the claim and not overpay the claim. Once again, showing the exercise of discretion, independent judgment, and not get more than what was owed. And when you talk about negotiation skills, who are you negotiating with? Well, after I do the estimate, sometimes I would talk with a body shop and try to get them to repair something instead of trying to replace it.
Is that function significantly greater than somebody who operates in the return department of a major, let's say, department store, where if you get a pleasant engagement with such an individual, you say, well, I'm going to continue to shop here. Is it your position because the MDA, if he or she has a good face for the company, the person will stay insured with X or Y? Is that the thrust of it? I mean,
it's not the complete thrust of it. It's certainly an aspect of it, however. Representing the company, according to the regulations, is precisely that which allows someone to be an exempt employee. Both of the witnesses in this case testified that customer service was a very important element of what they do. And let's recall what people are faced with when they've had an auto insurance claim is it's stressful. We're upset. I suppose we might be in the returns case as well. But representing the company well is, in fact, important to the insurance company clients in this case. The other point that I think is important to draw here is this issue about knowledge, skill, and experience. Because I would agree that when someone is making this decision to repair or replace a part, they do it with based on the knowledge, skill, and experience that they have. They get better at it if they have more knowledge, skill, and experience. Think about something that claims adjusters do here that all lawyers do, which is advise our clients about settling cases. I know that I'm better at that today because I have more experience. I also know that I'm better at that when I have more knowledge about other cases, about the case that I'm in, about the law. So the fact that I use knowledge, skill, and experience doesn't mean that I'm not exercising discretion and independent judgment in that decision. Those two things aren't mutually exclusive. And that's why the absence of factual issues is here, because oftentimes all they've done to create a factual issue is to add, well, I do this decision, but I do it based on my knowledge, skill, and experience. That doesn't create a dispute, because of course people use knowledge, skill, and experience. What the regulation cautions you against is confusing that with discretion and independent judgment, so that you're only using, let's say, the measurement tool that could be very sophisticated, but at the end of the day, all you're doing is measuring. You're not deciding.
What is the import of the new regulations that were promulgated just after this, or effective just after this lawsuit was filed? The DOL essentially renumbered and streamlined the old regulations where the duties test appeared, and then gave some examples of what qualifies, and said specifically that claims adjusters qualify.
Right. I think it is additional persuasive authority for the proposition that claims adjusters are exempt under the FLSA. I don't believe, as the Ninth Circuit apparently did in the Farmers case, that it is binding. However, in the regulation, they say that this is consistent with prior law, so there's really no change. That regulation then ticks off a number of elements, all of which exist here for claims adjusters. Do they interview insureds and witnesses? Yes. Do they inspect property damage? Yes. Do they review factual information to prepare damage estimates? Yes. That's precisely what MDAs do. Do they make recommendations regarding coverage? Do they determine liability and total value of a claim? Do they negotiate settlements? Do they make recommendations regarding litigation? That's true of the adjusters here. And I think, since it is consistent with prior law, it further bolsters a summary judgment here.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Heidenreich. Mr. Ashman.
Well, Your Honors, there was a 30B6 deposition taken of a CCSI employee on this very issue, and he testified that MDAs make decisions to repair or replace a damaged auto part based on their experience and training. And the ability to determine whether to replace or repair is a skill based on experience and training. Furthermore, there was a reference that our allegations or our positions on the record were not supported by the record. On the contrary, Paula Rowe Midget submitted an affidavit wherein she stated, which is not inconsistent with her testimony at deposition, as an MDA, I did not spend, on average, more than 5% of time during my workday negotiating prices with body shops. And to my knowledge, this percentage is consistent with time spent by other MDAs. So let's assume that the negotiation is as important as Mr. Heidenreich seems to think it is. It doesn't change the fact that if it's a minuscule part of your day, it's not a primary duty of that position. Furthermore, you know, there's also this further distinction made that it's somehow meaningful that this $600 million.
You may finish that though.
That this $600 million is handled by all these claims. I mean, if it's simply how much money is being generated for the company by the employee, then every drive-through clerk or guy working the French fry stand is going to that logic is going to apply in that situation as well.
All right.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Ashman. Our thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement and the